From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, could future Academy Award ceremonies honor the best screenplay written by an algorithm? Then why Bo Burnham, the writer-director of Eighth Grade, channeled his feelings about the internet into the character of a 13-year-old girl.
I was very interested in young people vlogging about their own life, and I watched hundreds and hundreds of videos, and not to be cruel to the boys, but on average, the boys of this age talked about Xbox and the girls this age talked about their souls.
And musician and photographer Anthony Wilson combines both disciplines for his latest release. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. This Sunday, there'll be an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay and for Best Adapted Screenplay. But could there soon be a trophy for Best Screenplay written by an algorithm? We've known for years that technology is radically changing the way that movies are made, but what's remained fairly constant is the human screenwriter. After all, you can't make a movie without someone writing the script, or can you? If one artificial intelligence company has its way, there's an algorithm out there that might be fighting for a share of the writing credit on the next studio blockbuster. We now revisit our piece with Frame contributor Colin Friesen, who explains it all.
If Robert Altman's movie The Player taught us anything, it's that making a hit movie takes a lot of creativity and, frankly, guesswork.
So it's kind of a psychic political thriller comedy with a heart.
With a heart. And not unlike Ghost meets Manchurian Candidate.
Conventional wisdom has it that no one ever knows exactly what audiences want or what will get butts in the seats. But screenwriter William Goldman's aphorism that in Hollywood no one knows anything may be changing. Here at the American Film Market in Santa Monica, where the world comes to buy and sell movies, there's a company that thinks it can answer that question. William Santer and Jack Jan are with Productivity Media, and they're here to introduce an artificial intelligence program that will read your script, analyze it for 40,000 data points or attributes, then will tell you how to change it to make it more successful.
A horror film that features a ghost and a child in peril has a 87% probability of overperforming the benchmark.
The other day we actually had a conversation on what kind of weapon was used in the action film. We have all kinds of breakdowns. If you use a pistol compared to a handgun, compared to a machine gun, we have all these granular details of these attributes.
You put all of that in and you go, you know what, if we change the handgun to a bazooka, this should outperform.
We can see how it would influence it.
The program draws on a database of 3,800 films going back to the 90s. It tracks what elements were in a movie and how well that film did in any number of demographic groups.
You know, computer will do a first run and say, oh, these are the potential elements, and we have recently just, you know, started working on getting another layer of people looking at those attributes and see, you know, how actual relevant they are to the story. So it's two-step. It's definitely AI. When you think about it, it's a complex problem it's solving, right?
Be it a comedy, drama, or thriller, their goal is to help any genre of picture become the most successful version of itself it can be. They call it overperforming the market, or making sure your cross-generational buddy cop comedy with a dog does better than any other cross-generational buddy cop comedy with a dog. It's like getting studio notes, but not from some slick executive with a gut feeling, but from a coldly calculating cyborg.
So it's just a tool set to, I always say, do one of two fundamental things. Number one, it's already going to confirm what you believe to be true about your project. Or two, it's going to give you an opportunity to ask another question.
It all started just a couple of years ago. Jan, an engineering student at the University of Waterloo in Canada, cold called a company called Productivity Media, a mid-sized film finance firm. Zhang was selling an algorithm that would predict how well a studio would do based on the movies they were releasing. Intrigued, the company decided to conduct an experiment. Using Zhang's database, they paid a film student to make a trailer with all the key elements of a successful horror film. Impossible Things, a movie that doesn't really exist, features a Victorian house and a bathtub and a ghost and a child in peril. It's honestly not much to look at, but the response on social media, 2.4 million views, was enough to tell them they were on the right track.
But this feels like something we should resist to keep creativity alive.
Monica Levinson is the president of production at Shiv Hans Pictures. The company has produced Trumbo and Captain Fantastic and a ton of other well-reviewed dramas. Levinson is not only skeptical, but worries that drawing on films that were successful, sometimes formulaic retreads with mostly white actors, might mean there's no place at the table for new voices and diverse casting choices.
All the things that we're trying to deal with now, having more women characters and having better representation and diversity and better representation of, just how characters behave, all of that will be continued because that bias will continue from what worked in the past. That's not what works today.
But Productivity Media says there's room in their analytics for all kinds of creative, progressive choices. Take the gay coming-of-age drama and Oscar winner Moonlight. When they ran that script through the algorithm, it determined the film would definitely find an audience.
You know, before it was made, we were able to tell based on the essential elements in the film, they have about 80% chance to outperform the marketplace.
And what was it about that movie that made you think or made the algorithm think that it was going to do well?
When we plug in, you know, a drama film with LGBT, those elements in it, that features African-American as the essential elements, the combination of those three already has a very significant influence on the outcome.
But it does beg the question, if everyone is making a movie with the same elements, won't that result in, well, the same kind of movies coming out? Santer says you need to think of it like music.
If we said to, you know, a whole bunch of musicians that we want a song that's written in 4/4 time in a key of C with this progression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we're going to get, you know, 20 different songs.
As for how screenwriters will react when and if their script feedback comes from an algorithm, maybe Nicolas Cage playing a version of screenwriter Charlie Kaufman in Adaptation summed it up best.
It's like, I don't want to cram in sex or guns or car chases, you know, or characters, you know, learning profound life lessons or growing or coming to like each other or overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end, you know. I feel very strongly about this.
For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
Coming up on The Frame, our conversation with Bo Burnham, the filmmaker behind Eighth Grade. He won the Best Original Screenplay Prize from the Writers Guild of America this past weekend, and he's nominated for Best Feature and Best First Screenplay at tomorrow's Independent Spirit Awards. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, independent filmmakers will gather under a massive tent set up in the parking lot next to the Santa Monica Pier to celebrate the Spirit Awards. They honor movies typically made outside the studio system. Among the nominated movies is Eighth Grade. It's in the running for 4 awards, including Best Feature. The comedian Bo Burnham, who made it big on the internet as a teenager with YouTube videos, wrote and directed Eighth Grade. And earlier this month, he won the Directors Guild of America Award for First Feature Film. Eighth Grade is about a 13-year-old girl named Kayla who makes self-help videos from her bedroom. Kayla is played by the newcomer Elsie Fisher, and the movie immerses you in her point of view. In one scene, she's lying in bed, scrolling through social media, while an Enya song plays in the background. When I met Bo Burnham after Eighth Grade premiered at last year's Sundance Film Festival, he told me how he was able to reach Enya to license her song for his movie.
I was like, do I write a note on like a salmon and put it in the Euphrates? Like, how do you contact, like, how do you get to Enya? Like, do I like release a smoke signal in the air? But I wrote a letter telling her what it meant to me, what it meant to the movie, and the price came down.
What did the song mean to you? I'm curious.
It meant something. I don't know. It was a certain portrayal of what I felt like it means to browse on the internet. That the internet is something strange and almost spiritual. I wanted it to feel sensory and deep.
But it's also like this kind of river of images. Like,
yeah,
she's
exactly
talking about sailing away,
yeah,
or
of
ocean
course
of images, whatever the water metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's the sort of ideas that, like, the kids have a choice in their bed every day. They can look at, like, the infinite amount of information in their pocket on their laptop, or they can look into the infinite blackness of their mind and their back of their eyelids. So, you know, that there really is, like, a choice between two, like, oblivions that is pretty ridiculous. Dance, 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 dance.
Did you set out to make a movie about eighth graders or the internet? Did one beget the other?
Definitely the internet. I set to make a story about how I was feeling, which is at the time I wrote the story, I was sort of coming to terms with the fact that I had anxiety and I felt like my feelings were tied in some way to the internet, and I wanted to talk about it. And my initial instinct was, okay, I have to write some big tandem narrative with 12 intersecting characters to get all these big ideas out. And then I stumbled on this voice, and I was like, I mean, I could say everything I want and more through her. That the sort of peripheral problems I have with the internet that exist around the core of my life, which is I have a job and I have to pay taxes. For a kid, it's everything.
What do you mean I stumbled on this voice? Was it somebody you heard yourself hearing? Is it somebody you saw doing YouTube videos?
I've always been interested in the YouTube videos that no one's watching. I've always been interested in people on the internet that are expressing themselves and no one's paying attention to, because the sort of narrative of the internet, we only ever talk about the people that go viral and the people that get paid attention to, but a majority of the internet are people calling out into a void and getting no answer.
Hey guys, Kayla back here with another video. Okay, so the topic of today's video is putting yourself out there. Okay, so like, what does that mean? Where is there? Well,
I was very interested in young people vlogging about their own life, and I watched hundreds and hundreds of videos, and not to be cruel to the boys, but on average, the boys of this age talked about Xbox, and the girls this age talked about their souls, you know, and I just think for whatever reason, if it's cultural pressure or whatever, girls are, I don't think it's just cultural, but I think girls are just a little deeper at that age and asking deeper questions of themselves.
Did you find that they were talking about their souls in an authentic way, or were they talking about their souls or themselves in a way that they thought other people would connect to? How much of it was kind of mediated by themselves in terms of the story they wanted to tell versus the story that was maybe truthful?
Yeah, well, I think all of it was mediated, and I think the actual story and the drama, hopefully, of the movie is that mediation, is that exact thing, the want to articulate yourself, the sense that I am failing to be in command of my narrative in the way that most people that I see in movies that I like are, for example, you know, she wants to be the protagonist that has that perfectly articulate voiceover that describes her life, but she can't. And I think if we're being honest with ourselves, it's part of all of our pressures. I mean, am I not also here hoping I'm coming off as articulate and intelligent and sensitive? Of course I am. I'm mediating the way I'm being perceived all of the time. It's just the failure of our mediation is just so much more apparent when we're young, so we can kind of forgive ourselves a little more. But to me, it's, if I'm honest with myself, I'm asking the same questions. I'm trying to do the same things she is. I'm trying to be myself. I'm trying to put myself out there. I'm trying to be confident. All that.
But there's something that I think is particular to eighth grade that takes all of those issues and puts them under an unbelievable amount of pressure.
Yes.
You're going through adolescence, so you're starting to think about sex and hormones and all those things are raging. You're about to enter high school, which is going to kind of maybe start you on a trajectory academically or professionally that you might not even have control over. And then relationships are forming between your peers that you can't quite control or understand.
Yeah, it's very – I always think it's like it's the most surreal social environment you are ever in at the most vulnerable time you ever are living. So it's like – and part of the movie is trying to hopefully discover these things like we're aliens seeing it for the first time. Like a pool party, why do we have these like young kids whose bodies are exploding in a pool of water, like clothed barely – like not clothed at all like they are in their normal lives. It just so – the situations are very, very surreal. Oh, there's 100 kids in an auditorium and one standing up at a podium trying to keep – like I realized – I had a real appreciation for teachers realizing just how – and all educators – how chaotic school is. Like I saw the kids on set and I was like, oh, if you all just decided you could take this over, that the structure is sort of – these like cultural norms are – barely hanging on, like, you know, as it is a really chaotic, strange time. So yes, I mean, that's what I talked about in terms of these feelings and worries are sort of fringe in my life, but It's almost like a drug experience being that age in terms of it being so sensory and just every tastes are more vivid and sounds are louder and things are brighter and the world is bigger. And that's what I wanted to feel like. I didn't want it to be a story that was remembered or nostalgic. I didn't want it to be polluted with my own memory or I want it to be felt in the moment viscerally.
We're talking with Bo Burnham. His new film is called Eighth Grade. I want to ask you about your creative collaboration with Elsa, your lead actress, and what she meant to you in terms of making sure that this story felt authentic to her. The way that kids like her talk, the things that they're uncomfortable talking about, the way she sees the world. How would you describe your partnership with her in telling this story?
I mean, like, essential to the point where I feel like it was almost irresponsible that we greenlit the movie before we found her. I told her every day, you know the truth of this more than anybody. I mean, my disconnect from you is twofold. I was never a 13-year-old girl, and I was never a 13-year-old right now. You are the only one on set that knows this. So you know the truth. This movie is coming to you, not the other way around. So there was a long rehearsal process, which was mostly for the script, mostly just to make sure that it sounded right. And if things didn't sound right, it was always the script's fault. So it's essential. You know, again, what I was trying to capture was what she was in many ways. So to have the real thing there, it's, you know, just completely subjugate myself to it.
How does social media affect a character like Kayla in this era that wouldn't have been true 20 years ago?
There's something about the internet and social media that I think forces kids to just kind of like atomizes themselves into you have the you living your life. You have the you watching yourself walk through your life. You have the you anticipating the next moment. You have the you anticipating the reaction to the next moment, watching people watch you, watching people watch you watch them. There's a really, really disorienting feeling, I think, to being alive right now in general, and it just especially affects kids that are vulnerable to it and too young to even realize it. But I don't know if any of us really have processed just how strange it is to be our own storytellers and not only have to live our life but to have to curate our lives. And I think it's interpreted by older generations as narcissism, and it isn't. It's self-involved, but in a really sad way that is not fun, and it's a norm culturally. I mean, it's like not, you know, it's not like you can't really opt out of this stuff, or then you're alone. You know, it's the weird oxymoron of the internet where it's like it's overstimulating and numbing, it's hyperconnective, and we're all super lonely.
So, did it raise in your mind the making of this film more questions about how we process or unprocess all this stuff than it answered?
Well, I mean, from the process of writing, you know, I was certain that this movie was coming out in Hillary's America, first of all, you know, and then, you know, He Happened, which is, you know, a sort of, in my mind, a very sort of perfect summation of the internet in some weird way. So I don't, the world has gotten more confusing. Culture has gotten more strange. So I don't, but I have an emotional clarity through it with my collaboration with Elsie of just, you know, trusting myself and that at the end of the day, these problems are personal and my real struggle is my own anxiety and my own feelings and calming down and getting out of my head. And the other stuff will sort itself out or it won't.
Bo, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, musician and photographer Anthony Wilson combines both of those disciplines for his latest release. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. LA-based guitarist, arranger, and composer Anthony Wilson is the son of the late great jazz trumpeter, composer, and bandleader Gerald Wilson. While jazz is a foundation of sorts for Wilson, he has also accompanied Paul McCartney, Aaron Neville, and Willie Nelson. He's also been a member of Diana Krall's ensemble since 2001. Wilson's latest project combines his own music and his own photography. The Frame contributor Linnell George has this review.
Anthony Wilson's latest release, Songs and Photographs, reminds us what we've lost in our departure from the analog life, both in music and in snapshots that serve as rich repositories of emotion and memory. This new work is an album in the purest sense, an unfolding collection of images, both sonic and visual, meant to be taken as a whole, intended for reflection. For years now, Wilson's creative journeys have avoided strict labels. Songs and Photographs is no different. It's an assemblage of observations and revelations rolling through time and space. And accompanying it all is a sequence of quietly evocative photographs shot on film, taken from his journeys across the country and around the globe. The opening piece, The Palmist Hand, which you're hearing now, is an ebullient, shimmering, mystical mood. If Songs and Photographs were a film, this would be the establishing shot. You fall into its locomotion, its opening sonic vistas. And for this foray, not only has Wilson set down lyrics, he also provides the vocals.
While we slept through the long night.
While We Slept feels like a journal entry, just Wilson's plaintive voice, first backed only by his guitar. And then the spare arrangement continues to build and fill in with colors until a lush instrumental section materializes, like an image shimmering up in a dark room's developing tray. Many of the compositions in Songs and Photographs render environments. They feel like navigable locales. We're rolling through time and space as if by train. Locations flash by, overtaken by the next. The compositions aren't sentiments, they are situations. We can experience them with all of our senses. Song from a Dream, which may be the most straight-ahead jazz cut on the album, features a luminous Gerald Clayton on piano, and it swings hard. Wilson is a tumbleweed, and over time he's collected bits and pieces of what he's traveled through, both as a player and an observer-listener. Laurel Canyon's introspections, Dark to Dawn mysterious opening vistas. Tune to tune, the album reveals Wilson's fluidity, his ease in many settings. He reaches for mood, the elements that might best relate the subject at hand. Maybe it's the simplicity of a single voice, maybe it's a jazz embellishment, or an unshakable New Orleans second line beat, as in Listen to My Heartbeat. It's all evidence of the journey. The photo sequencing establishes a complementary arc, a walkabout. The elegant accompanying book is an album of small gestures, incidental moments, and visual side chatter. Wilson's eloquent photographs, 22 in all, were shot with a 1959 Canon rangefinder. They record the small, often unnoticed details that, taken together, create an atmosphere. In the fraction of a second, the shutter opens and closes. It's his way, he sings in the title cut, Songs and Photographs, of taming chaos, slowing time.
Breathless, I sit watching as the blue hourglass drains. With my camera, I go out walking.
Much like the ritual of walking, looking, and composing, Wilson's album entices the listener to slow down, to examine details and layers. A sky drained of color, an empty nest, the found poems within graffiti or ghost signs, reflections within reflection. In lyrics, he frames the tiniest of moments, colored pencils in a gold leaf case, the growth of a hedge, the act of recovering last night's dream, to create an album of moments and gestures. Wilson's act of observation shows us that everything we perceive is a continuous flow of experience. All that richness and those imperfections become the album we call our memories. We too are analog.
Dust in the finder, haze in the lens, perspectives that warp, shadows that bend.
As an artist, Wilson pushes beyond expectations, both the listener's and his own. Songs and Photographs is heedless of labels. It's what music would be if both record companies and consumers weren't compelled to affix or expect them. The result is a record that defies genre, proudly and boldly, full of unexpected turns and vivid introspective vistas. Songs and Photographs settles Wilson in a fertile creative landscape where, as he sings in While We Slept, there's no fear, and in this place where I have landed, can I take a look around and stay? For The Frame, I'm Linnell George.
And that is it for this week. Be sure to check out The Frame's Academy Awards preview this weekend. You can first catch it tonight at 7 right here on KPCC. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Andrea Gutierrez. Our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Enjoy the Oscars. We'll have a lot to say about the show back here on Monday.